Okay, so we're finally going to get into pathways, and we're actually going to start with the oldest known pathway. This was started to be, well, actually, first people to really sort of investigate this was Louis Pasteur. So that's 1850s. And what Pasteur actually did a really interesting experiment that got people sort of thinking. Any common molecules were called organic because they came from life, right? And so the sort of notion that carbon and life and organic, right, was all together, and that that these kinds of reactions were occurring in living organisms. It never occurred to anybody that you could actually kill the organism, break it open, and actually get the same reactions to work, right? And that was busted up. That idea was really broken up by Louis Pasteur, who really started breaking up living organisms and actually getting fermentation to occur and a whole bunch of other things. And that really was a conceptual breakthrough, because then that meant you could fractionate the components of the reaction, you could start to purify things. And by the 1920s, this became a profession, especially in Europe. In Germany and a number of other places, the biochemists just ate this up and just started working out what happened, what were the intermediates and so forth. And by the time I was a graduate student in the 1960s, we were forced to take courses to memorize all this stuff. And it was a rough equivalent of taking an organic chemistry course. It was really awful. And so we probably forgot it. That's a great example of putting it in short-term memory and never transferring it to long-term memory. And it seemed to be useful, but seemed to be sort of over as a science. And as I mentioned, in the 20s, Otto Warburg, who is one of these wonderful German biochemists, started looking at cancer cells versus normal cells, and he really said, look, this is a real difference here in the metabolism of cancer cells and normal cells. Cancer cells use glycolysis, and they're not using oxidative phosphorylation, and normal cells use oxidative phosphorylation. And as I say, that was pretty roundly ignored by everybody, or I would say not understood. He actually claimed it was the answer to cancer. He actually claimed that if you understood this, you would understand why cancer occurs. And then it was actually the value of it and the utility of it became clearer and clearer after, for years and years, 50, 60 years, started to sink in. And so it is true that cancer, it's not true for all cancer cells, but some subset of cancer cells really run their metabolic pathways quite differently than normal cells do. And that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to start off by metabolic pathways. So let's start off with the normal situation, since everybody's sitting here digesting lunch, and everybody, this is happening in everybody right this minute. Anybody that ate lunch, anyhow. Well, actually, even if you starved yourself and didn't eat any lunch, there's other processes that are happening that are not so dissimilar. You're mobilizing your stores of glucose out of starch in the liver, and you're starting to do the same thing, anyhow. So as I mentioned, the two major molecules that are metabolized to gain energy and gain substrates for all other molecules, for the degradation and the biosynthesis of molecules, are glucose, which is up there in your upper left, and glutamine, which is over here. Glutamine is one of the 20 amino acids. And glutamine has the advantage of bringing in a nitrogen group so that you supply nitrogen. Glucose is, of course, only carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen. It's a sugar. Right. Now, the first thing to say is that, so glucose comes in from the outside into a cell. This would be a liver cell, for example. That's where you do a lot of your metabolism normally. And it doesn't come in passively. There are glucose transporters. So that means that there are channels which will take in glucose and nothing else. But these channels are perfectly reversible. There's about 14 of these channels. They're called glute channels, or glucose channels. And there's about 14 of them, and so they're called GLU1, GLU2, GLU3, GLU4. I've stuck up there GLU1 through 4, which are the most common ones that have been studied in cancer. The multiplicity of channels is partly due to tissue distribution, partly due to some other kinds of affinities and things like that. These channels are perfectly reversible, so glucose could go in and out. And so the very first step is to use ATP to phosphorylate glucose, and you get glucose 6-phosphate. Now, there's a big advantage to doing that, and that is charged molecules don't pass membranes. So putting a phosphate group on glucose means it's trapped inside and not outside, and now you've got it trapped. And at that point, the other really sort of interesting fact emerges, that if you go down this pathway, which is called glycolysis, glucose to fructose, that's just an isomerase reaction, it's just changing the positions of the hydrogens and oxygens in the hydroxyl groups. So to fructose 6-phosphate, and then fructose 1,6-bisphosphate, biphosphate, down to phosphoglycerol mutase and the creation of pyruvate, right? And what that is taking a 6-carbon sugar to a 3-carbon sugar, and the cleavage of the bonds will gain you some energy, right? That's the purpose of that first thought. However, you do have a choice. If you're in a biosynthetic mode, you change glucose, which is a 6-carbon sugar, to ribose, which is a 5-carbon sugar, so you're eliminating one of the carbons that way. And ribose phosphate, right, now instead of glucose 6-phosphate, ribose 5-phosphate, right, is the precursor to all nucleic acids. So ribose for RNA, deoxyribose for DNA, but is the precursor for nucleic acid synthesis, right? So you can see that this is being utilized in two different ways. One is biosynthetic, and that sometimes you're in the biosynthetic pathway mode, and the other is a degradation of the glucose to get energy, right? You gain a couple of ATP now. So in other words, you can measure the energy you gain from these reactions because of the cleavage of the carbon bonds and the hydrogen bonds, the oxygen bonds. You can measure it by how many ATP molecules you get. You gain about 2 ATP molecules in glycolysis. Right.
That is after you use that 1 ATP?
After you use it 2 ATPs, yeah.
So you're using
the net is gaining 2.
Net is gaining 2.
Right.
You're using 2,
that's right.
And you gain 4, so you net 2.
Yes.
Okay.
So you have pyruvate. And now, under normal conditions, pyruvate will diffuse into mitochondria. So mitochondria are these little organelles in the cytoplasm of the cells. They have their own DNA. They have about 60 or 70 genes. They have their own ribosomes. So they make their own ribosomes, their own ribosomal proteins. They have their own protein synthesis machinery. But they also have a series of enzymes which carry out what's called oxidative phosphorylation, which is to take pyruvate to acetyl-CoA, if that's just a 2-carbon sugar now, and to run it around the cycle called the tricarboxylic acid cycle, or Krebs cycle. Krebs was Warburg's contemporary. Krebs cycle. Run it around the cycle and burn it to CO2 and water. And if you burn it all the way to CO2 and water, you get about 32 ATPs. That actually changes with age. There's nothing magic about these numbers, how many ATPs you get. You run downhill a bit. So at my age, I'm maybe getting 28 ATPs instead of 32 out of my glucose, right? And that's just the inefficiency of the system that's sort of degrading. So when the question was asked, should we be sequencing mitochondrial DNA and should we be looking at mitochondria, in so much as cancer occurs with age, one has a system that's running down a little bit. These ribosomes and ribosomal proteins, by the way, mitochondria have, they look much more like bacterial ribosomes and ribosomal proteins than they do like eukaryotes. And they're even inhibited by inhibitors of bacterial antibiotics. The antibiotics that inhibit the ribosome and translation inhibit the mitochondria, right? So what it looks like is that some bacteria parasitized an organism in the past. The bacteria then degenerated so that it's completely a parasite. It can't live on its own. But it actually is a synergistic parasite in that it's now producing a whole new set of cycles for you that is giving you energy. And this was such a big advance that it caught on in evolution, and we all now have that.
Before that, you just throw away the pyruvate after the glycolysis?
Well, yeah, you could, and you can live on that, yeah. So oxidative phosphorylation is, as the name says, it in fact occurs in oxygen. You have to have high oxygen content. So you're burning the acetyl-CoA around the cycle to CO2 and water. You're adding oxygen. right? And it's a hot reaction that you're burning. It's an oxidative reaction. And what you're doing is you're transferring electrons out of these molecules into an electron transport chain, which is shown down here, called the oxidative phosphorylation chain, right? These are cytochromes. These are iron-containing cytochromes, which pick up electrons, and then they pass them along. And these electrons are donated, and so they oxidize at a high rate. And this actually throws off protons. And the way you make ATP is that the whole mitochondria behaves like a proton pump. So it's really quite nice. It pumps out protons, and you make an ATP, and it brings it back in, and then pumps out protons, you make an ATP, right? And so what you get as the product of glucose is carbon dioxide and water, right? Which is exactly, so glucose that's burned completely to carbon dioxide and water gives you about 32 ATPs, it gives you per mole of glucose, gives you carbon dioxide and water, and that's the most efficient process you have, right? You, anytime you exercise and plenty of oxygen, you're doing it that way, right?
How can, how can that system age? Like you're saying that's in your age or so, it's like 30.
Breaks down a little bit, yeah.
Is that the bottom mitochondria that age?
I think I'm making entropic mistakes over time. I mean, I think I'm facing the second law of thermodynamics and running downhill. That's what, stochastic errors, components,
the
accumulation of mutations, whatever, however it happens. I know I'm not making, I can measure it, right? That's how I know I'm not efficient, right? I don't mean this personally, but I mean anyone my age. I'm age appropriate for the number of ATPs I make, but I'm not an extremist here, but I'm not, you're not as efficient as you go along life. I hate to say that to you, but you're just going downhill.
The mitochondria sort of.
They're one way to measure. It's just one way to measure it, right? There are many ways to measure it, but that's one way. Yeah.
So it's mitochondria and DNA mutates, you're saying?
Mitochondria does have DNA. It has its own chromosome. It makes some of its own proteins.
It mutates with age. Is that what you're suggesting? The proteins are different. Or what could be different?
It does accumulate mutation. Mutation rate is slightly higher in mitochondria than it is in the nucleus. And one of the reasons is that it's making lots of oxygen species. And these reactive oxygens, it makes peroxides, for example. If I don't have a really good electron transport chain, I make peroxides. And these peroxides react with DNA, they make mutations, they make breaks. They react with proteins, they inactivate my proteins. They react with lipids and they make them stiff, right? Instead of malleable. So if I'm making too many peroxides, I'm running hot, right? I'm running oxidative in a redox potential way, right?
And what rejuvenates then when you get
So there's a process there's a process called autophagy. Mitophagy, sometimes it's called. It watches these bad mitochondria and it engulfs them and degrades them. Right? So there's a repair process. It's just that nothing is as efficient as it was. So I'm making a few less ATPs. Yeah. Okay. So I'm just use that as one measure of aging. It's not the only measure. It's just one measure. Okay. Now so that's the way you normally would do it. Now. If you get on your bicycle and start really pumping away, or you're running, right? Now you start limiting for oxygen. Right? You can tell that because you're breathing harder, you're breathing faster, you're trying to get more oxygen in. And you can become hypoxic. That is to say, you have suboptimal oxygen being taken in, right? The advantage of glycolysis, it can run in anaerobic conditions. So if you took in no oxygen or very little oxygen, you'd still get glucose all the way down to pyruvate. And that would be terrific because that would get you a couple of ATPs to continue running and biking, right, in the absence of oxygen, right? But you go no further because you can't use oxidative phosphorylation under those conditions. So what you would do is you start taking the reducing agents you have in the cell because you're starving for oxygen, and you'd reduce pyruvate to lactate, right? And then the lactate would be secreted from the cell. So if you are running your reactions aerobically, right, lactate gets secreted. And that's why your muscles hurt, you're secreting lactic acid into your muscles, right? And so when you get stiff, actually it's the lactic acid in the muscles, and it means that you haven't efficiently degraded the glucose, but you've used it under anaerobic conditions, under conditions in which oxygen was limiting. And that's quite good about glycolysis, is that it's a fast way to get the energy without oxygen, or in limiting oxygen, right?
So recovering from stiff muscles is because the oxidative phosphorylation clears the lactate?
Yeah, actually the lactate goes back into cells, it then gets processed back into the pyruvate system and then can be cleared. So that's one way. There may be other ways that it's digested, or you can excrete the lactate, right? But you get rid of the lactate, yeah.
So what cells can live without oxygen for more than, cannot live without
oxygen? Not without oxygen, it's in low oxygen, I would say.
But if you stop breathing, for example, underwater, which cells would die, why would you?
I don't know which cells die first, yeah. No, I don't think the experiment's been done that way, actually.
Not in the mouse.
If we put you in the water, we could ask you questions.
You could ask mouse questions.
And you could ask the mouse questions, it's not going to answer you. We have to do it with someone who can communicate, right? Okay, so we have this afternoon's experiment planned. I don't know which ones die first. I do know that the brain doesn't like lack of oxygen pretty quick, a lot. In fact, you could look at the reverse question to get some information. Where is the blood flow assured to? It's the heart and the brain, right? So those are probably really privileged organs that would go first.
Bacteria which use oxygen, do they have this oxidative phosphorylation?
No. So bacteria stop here.
But some of them do use oxygen, right?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, and they can find pathways that are not oxidative phosphorylation that use pyruvate. Yeah, but then they use pyruvate to ferment, right? So what they ferment is alcohol. So this is a 3-carbon sugar, but you can ferment ethanol with 2-carbon alcohol. You can make acetic acid, 2-carbon acid. You can make an aldehyde, acetaldehyde, right? Acetaldehyde is another example of making a byproduct from the alcohol that's really bad for you. So bacteria generally stop in here and then use other means. Yeah?
E. coli have oxidative phosphorylation. E. coli have oxidative phosphorylation.
They have oxidative phosphorylation. E. coli. Yeah. But not mitochondria. They don't have mitochondria.
No. They don't.
Yeah. They have a method to take acetyl-CoA. Well, which is used for biosynthesis of membranes more than it's used for. They don't have cytochrome oxidase, I don't think.
Yeah.
They do. Okay. E. coli can.
I think the cell surface instead of
the. Cyanobacteria have oxidative phosphorylation.
They may, yeah. But it's not set up in this way.
They have no mitochondria.
Yeah. Okay, so that's when the oxygen is present, you would efficiently use it this way, right? So you can do that. Now, there are, but you have a sense, I think, from this. Here you have lipid synthesis, you have amino acid synthesis, you have nucleotide synthesis. This is going to be used for synthesis as well as for degradation. Those are the two paths that you would use. And now the embryo, which divides very rapidly. So remember, an early embryo is dividing with 6-8 hour generation times. Tremendous repetitiveness. It switches out of an oxidative phosphorylation state and uses what's called aerobic glycolysis. It has plenty of oxygen because the placenta is giving it a lot of oxygen. Well, it's not in the placenta yet even. But it has plenty of oxygen. But it's using glycolysis as its major form of ATP. That's true for wound healing, that's true for the immune system, as I told you, and that's true for cancer cells. And it's what Warburg pointed out, that pyruvate to lactate was a common end product pathway in many cancer cells. Right? The reason that Warburg was generally ignored is just your intuitive feeling that that's the least efficient way to generate ATP. Why is this cell using the least efficient way? Well, Warburg had one answer, and that was that cancer cells use 10 times the amount of glucose that normal cells do. All right? So the first thing the cancer cell compensates to make 10, 20 extra ATPs, right, is it moves up by tenfold the amount of glucose it pulls in. That means the glucose transporters are actually overexpressed. So one of the common observations in cancer cells is glucose transporters are overexpressed, and it takes up 10 times as much glucose. This is a diagnostic. This is actually so common. It's not true for all cancer cells, but it is used diagnostically for cancer cells, right? So what you do is you take the isotope F19, fluorine 19, deoxyglucose, right? Deoxyglucose can't be metabolized because it's deoxy, it's not glucose. And it has a fluorine on it that's radioactive. You feed it to the cancer patient. Some tissues take that, brain would take up a lot, right? Heart would take up a lot, but tumors take up tenfold more than other normal tissues. So if you had a liver tumor, suddenly it would all show up with F19 emission, right? That's called PET scanning, right? And PET scanning is just looking for the 2-deoxyglucose rate of uptake abnormally high in certain tissues. Okay? So that actually is a diagnostic test used in the hospital to tell you you've got a tumor and where it is. It also sees metastases, it sees a number of other things, right? And then there's some tissues that take up very high rates of glucose to begin with.
So are cancer patients told to take less glucose or to take...
No. In fact, they're frequently losing weight, and we'll talk about why they're losing weight.
Juice from a father.
Yeah. They're frequently losing weight, not gaining weight, but we'll talk about why that might happen, right? Now, if you take up 10 times the amount of glucose, right, it still wouldn't be really great if the amount of enzyme activity was rate-limiting and you couldn't process the glucose, right? So it turns out you can turn up glycolysis by about 100-fold. It's really quite an amazing thing. Coordinately, all the enzymes in the glycolytic pathway can be turned up. And the transcription factors that transcribe those genes are MYC, oncogene, right, and HIF-1-alpha. HIF-1-alpha is the gene responsible for responding to hypoxia. Right? So it's very common when a new tumor forms, if you think about it. It's a small tumor. If it's adjacent to blood vessels and capillaries, it's fed, okay. And then it starts growing, and it doesn't have its own capillaries and blood vessels, and it becomes hypoxic. And it responds by making HIF-1-alpha, which brings in blood vessels, right, to feed the tumor, but also induces glycolysis, right? Anaerobic glycolysis. Yes?
Well, all the lactate that is produced in this process isn't problematic, doesn't bother the cell.
Yeah, it's certainly, you can actually measure the lowering of the pH around the tumor. Some people say, for the structural people in the audience, some people say, and the extracellular matrix people, that actually the environment is changed such that the association of cells with matrices, the laying down of the matrix itself, and the structure of the cell is affected by this low pH. It's a little harder to document, but there's a literature that suggests this low pH and the lactate concentration that's being secreted, you're right, it's tenfold more than normal. It's in fact, you don't normally even excrete it, right? It is another way to try to diagnose a tumor, and it is has an impact on the environment. Ill-defined, though, impact, yeah.
It screams for an idea to attack a tumor in that way.
Yes. Yeah.
Instead of putting a fluoride, you put a poison on the sugar and
yeah.
Try to poison tumor cells. I'm sure that's been tried.
Yeah.
Well,
poisoning the sugar is a really bad thing in the sense that your brain sort of likes glucose too. Right? Glucose is too set. It's almost like saying, if I put arsenic in on your food, you know, yeah, we'll get the tumor.
If it takes up 10 times more, you just need sort of poison that.
Yeah, it is true that every drug's a toxin if you give it too much, right? And
yeah.
So in that sense, if you could titrate it just right, it does scream for it. You're bringing up interesting questions. For example, the synthesis of nucleic acids, right, would be a very sensitive step to try to inhibit, right? For the same reason. You're making many more nucleic acids in the tumor than you are in the normal turnover of cells. And a lot of people try that. I mean, these all these folate compounds, these one carbon inhibitors, and
if you had something that, let's say, reacts with lactate and becomes a poison.
So people have inhibited the pyruvate to lactate step and asked the question, what happens? And pyruvate piles up and gets secreted. And
I basically want something that comes to the low pH of the lactate, and because of the low pH, something like that.
Yeah, you could do that. You could make a balm that
goes
off.
Well, obviously I can't. But
someone might try. Yeah.
Let's continue. Okay.
He's my monitor. You've got to be very careful. Okay, so these two enzymes, these two transcription factors, Nick, which is a common one that's up, and it's throwing the cell into very rapid growth, right, is doing that. And by staying in glycolysis, right, you have tenfold more glucose, you really start to build lipids, you really start to build nucleic acids, you really start to build amino acids, right? Okay. Under more normal conditions, now there's a second thing that's happening. The other large substrate that Nick induces for utilization is glutamine. And here's glutamine. Glutamine is one of the 20 amino acids, right? It's taken up in the cell through a transporter. So these transporters are interesting places to attack. Right? And the glutamine has to be changed from glutamine to glutamate. This is actually a very good example of making a bomb, right? The glutamine has to be changed from glutamine to glutamate to be processed, right? It's actually, there are two glutaminases that do that. The enzyme that makes glutamine to glutamate is called glutaminase, and there's two of them, glutaminase 1 and 2, and boy, are they the opposite enzymes, and we don't know why. 1 and 2 are totally different than their treatments, right? Glutamate, if you come in with GLUT1, right? Glutamine to glutamate. Glutamate goes to glutamate in the mitochondria. It goes to alpha-ketoglutarate, that's one of the intermediates, right? It goes to malate, right? It goes to oxoxalate, it goes to citrate, and then it goes out and it'll go lipid synthesis and amino acid synthesis and amino acid synthesis here, right? Now, one of the things that is happening in this cell where glutamine comes in and you're using this channel is you get peroxides made in here, right? You're running very hot reactions in the redox potential. That means you're oxidizing lots of things. You're making peroxides by mistake. These peroxides are making DNA damage. They're killing proteins and so forth, right? So this is a redox called the redox potential of the cell. It moves to a very oxygen-rich redox potential, and it is a way to get genomic instability, which is not good. Right? The cell responds by making a reducing agent that will inactivate it. That's called glutathione. Glutathione is made from glutamine. That's good. Glutamine to glutathione, but it needs a reducing agent, and the reducing agent is DPNH. NADPH, right? NADPH. Anywhere you make NADPH is very good for cooling, right? Because it's giving you more glutathione. And that sets the redox potential, right? So cancer cells usually run pretty hot. And they require a coolant. By coolant, I mean a reducing agent, right? Oxidation, loss of electrons, cooling gain of electrons, right? They require coolant to keep the balance. Otherwise, these cells will chew themselves up, right? Because of the way they're running tenfold more glucose, right? And this is a very interesting place to start thinking about fooling around. The redox potential is watched by, of all things, P53. If it goes too hot in the oxygens, it will kill the cell. It just won't allow it to happen and create genomic instability, right? So this redox potential is monitored and watched, and it's in the cancer cell interest to keep generating NADPH by every method that it can. That would mean malate back to pyruvate, right?
Is the redox potential uniform over the whole cell?
We don't know that. But lots of proteins change their shape and conformation depending on the redox potential. You could get folding problems because of that. It has major effects on the cell, but we don't know if it's localized or it's a concept more than it is a... Well, you can measure. You can measure the glutathione and the peroxide. output of a particular cell. Right? Now, when glutamine goes to glutamate, right, it gives up the amine. So, amino acids have an amine group and a carboxyl group. And glutamine is a little unusual. It's like asparagine, in that it has a second amine, right, on the other side of the amino acid. So it's giving up an NH, right? And it would normally generate ammonia. And too much ammonia is toxic for cells, right? So the way the cell gets around that problem is it runs a reaction called the transaminase reaction, where it takes the ammonia and puts it on something else, right? And then it activates it, so you don't get ammonia, right? If you block the transaminase, you get ammonia. If you get ammonia, you kill the cells. That's a strategy when you're dependent upon glutamine, right? That's a whole new strategy that's worked out in the last 3 years. It was first found in yeast, which were growing on glutamine. They didn't have the transaminase, so they were dying of ammonia death. And people then realized that growing on glutamine is dangerous unless you trap the amine from ammonia and then put it onto something, right? So that's been a new strategy, right? Now, the enzyme that induces glutaminase 1 that allows this pathway is MYC. It's the transcription factor MYC. So any cell that's terribly dependent on MYC is utilizing glutamine in its pathway. Now, in fact, pancreatic cancers, so a really great experiment has been done by a couple of people. One is a surgeon who operates on pancreatic cancers in the University of Pennsylvania. He's taken out 24 pancreatic cancers. He's wrapped them up and frozen them, FedExed them to Princeton University. They come out of the FedEx. They're crumbled, they're crushed. They go through the mass spec. And now you look at the metabolic intermediates and their pathway. And you find that all pancreatic cancers are dependent upon glutamine for growth. The first thing they do is take all the glutamine out of your serum. Right? So now you don't even have any amino acids left to supply through here. They're using it up at such a high rate. Then it starts taking proteins out of your serum. And it brings the proteins into the cells. It puts them in a compartment called the endosome compartment, or autophagosome compartment, right? And it degrades them. And then it takes the glutamine and uses it, right? And your albumin levels go way down because of that, right? So it is abnormally utilizing, degrading amino acids from other sources. And that's part of this wasting syndrome that you see in people with pancreatic cancer. They get very thin. They're losing protein. It's coming out of their cells. It's coming out of their serum, right? And this wasting syndrome called cachexia is through this kind of pathway. Right? So it's quite an interesting thing we're now starting to find out, that there are tumors totally dependent on glutamine, and that's a pathway you could block, especially by this transaminase inhibitor. Yes?
I'm going to go back to that experiment, the HealthX experiment yesterday that you put up there. Because you told me two facts.
Yes.
Two facts. One was that you said with age, you said the number of ATP that you can get out of this reaction
declines.
But you also made the cancer statement, which makes me think about that curve then. So if I asked you, as you're going towards M1 or something, in non-cancer cells, is your, what's the equivalent curve there? I guess
I'm trying to for the efficiency of ATP?
Yeah.
I don't know how to put it, superimpose it on that.
Okay.
And I'm not even sure what happens to oxidative phosphorylation with division time in the culture.
Yeah.
Because that, in some sense, that's a very different environment than the environment of spending your life in my body, right? And so I don't know how to answer that, but I think that it's an interesting question. And people could look at the effect on mitochondrial efficiency. By the way, you don't need mitochondria. There are yeast mutants that don't have any mitochondria. You can live with glycolysis pretty well. It's just you're living less efficiently. Right. Okay, so there is another glutaminase that I've told you about called glutaminase 2, which takes glutamine to glutamate, but it is an enzyme regulated by P53. And it has exactly the opposite effect. It takes the glutamine and restores the TCA cycle. So one of the things, so just as HIF-1-alpha and MYC are positive regulations of the Warburg effect through transcription, P53 is negatively regulating the Warburg effect through transcription, right? So these are the checks and the balances. And nowhere is that more striking than the glutaminase 1 and glutaminase 2 issue, where MYC is giving you glut 1 and P53 is giving you glut 2. P53 also gives you a cytochrome oxidase here, and the cytochrome oxidase helps the TCA cycle, right? So P53 turns on the TCA cycle, anti-Warburg, right? And it actually modulates down the glycolysis, the opposite. It negatively regulates the transcription of phosphoglycerol mutase. It makes a protein called TIGER, which slows the rate at which fructose goes to fructose 1,6 bisphosphate, right? So there are positive and negative checks and balances. And what the reason why Warburg was really right, and the thing we never knew until now, right, is that oncogenes are regulating the positive Warburg effect, and tumor suppressor genes are regulating the movement into the TCA cycle, right? And so the very regulatory elements for this metabolic pathway are inherent in the body, and they are the genes that are mutated in cancer, right?
Yeah. Are there any exceptions to Warburg effect in cancer?
Yes, many. Okay. So you could be a cancer without a Warburg effect. So, and an easy way to see that is that PET scan negative cancer. An easy way to see it, because you can't be a Warburg effect without high glucose. So nothing I say, so this is part of this sort of unfortunate heterogeneity, right? I guess it's easy on the lecturer, because you can't make the wrong statement that everything is right, right? And we don't even know if I can't even make the statement that aggressive cancers use Warburg and non-aggressive don't, right? I can't quite make that statement, but it needs someone to make those measurements, right? And it needs to be in the same kind of tumor with the staging right. And so it's a little bit of an elaborate experiment, but you can phrase those questions for the first time now as we sort of pop up and look at this.
Can you study this in cell lines already, or cell
yes.
lines?
Yes, oh, yes. Very easy to study it in cell lines. Cell lines are using the Warburg effect.
Always.
Almost always. So actually, if any of you have grown cells in culture, one of the things you see is as they grow up and as the density gets high, the pH of the medium goes down. That's lactose. That's less lactate, right? So they're just pouring out lactate in the tissue culture dish. And that pH change tells you that they've used up all the glucose. Right.
Yeah, but that's even without cancer, is it just because we're talking HeLa cells?
So it is the cancer cells especially, but actually normal cells will pump out lactate too, because they're not happy in culture. They're not as efficient as they might have been in your liver, for example.
If you would, through any other mutation, turn off oxidative phosphorylation, so force the cells to live in glycolysis, so presumably they will increase their glucose intake. Will they start to resemble a little bit more cancer cells as the division rate goes up if you turn off oxidative phosphorylation?
So I'll take you through a couple of examples of things like that, and you'll sort of get a sense. So we can knock out, so remember I said this is the tumor suppressor genes and the oncogenes are battling out what the ratio here of these things, right? And we can knock out P53 in the mouse. Right? And that mouse goes on the ground and it's running around its cage. And you look at it and you couldn't tell him that mouse had any problem, right? But if I exercise that mouse and I put the mouse on a wheel, right? So that's your running or your biking, right? It wears out very fast. And it wears out very fast because it's got to do this. And it can't do this, right? Just because of the absence of P53 isn't clicking this in, right? Okay. And it isn't slowing down. So I can find physiological impacts of this. These things just don't get made up for cancer. They actually have physiological impacts upon all stress situations. That's a stress situation. When you're running, you're out of breath, you're low oxygen content, right? And there's no way to click you back into oxidative phosphorylation without these guys, right? MYC is a lethal event, so I can't take it away. HIF-1-alpha, I can slow down, but I don't know if I can take away. So, and there are yeasts without mitochondria just do fine. But again, you know, we're growing everything in such artificial conditions that it's a little bit hard to say.
I think Robin's question was not on the physiological level, but on a particular cell level. And I've done some experiments along this line where we have stem cells in culture. And various ways we can either suppress oxidative phosphorylation or stimulate glucose. And in every case that we've tried, the cells go through more rounds of self-renewing divisions before differentiation. So there's a very clear phenotype for multiple cell types. And also, the more reducing we made the cellular intercellular environment, the more they would go through self-renewing divisions too, so consistent with that.
So it has an impact on the time and the stage at which you make a commitment to development and differentiation. And remember, it's early in development that you're relying on Warburg-like effect to get big, and then you could move to organogenesis and differentiation. So these things have all been programmed in for normal physiological reasons, and they just reoccur in these cancer cases. Okay? Now, there's actually a signal transduction pathway that regulates glucose metabolism. Yep. And that's the other pathway that we'll just talk about. That's the insulin-like growth factor pathway. Right? So let me say that this is one representation of the insulin-like growth factor pathway. It's a nice one because it will start to get us into a number of things, and we can go onto the board and flesh out things. Remember I said there are hormones. In this case, the hormone I represented is called insulin-like growth factor, IGF-1. It's a hormone made in response to glucose. So you have taken in glucose at lunch, right? Your pancreas, the beta cells, sense the glucose level in the blood is high, and they respond by putting out just the right amount of insulin, which is going to be absolutely essential for the glucose transport and to move glucose into the cell, right? Insulin is going to regulate glucose transporter levels, right? And it triggers a second hormone called insulin-like growth factor, right? Now, it turns out any growth factor will trigger this pathway because you're moving into growth, and this is a pathway that's quintessentially first mass increase, second division, right? That's its goal in this pathway. So here's the insulin-like growth factor up on top, and it is going to react with something called the insulin-like growth factor receptor. Every growth factor has its own receptor, right? Now let's just talk a minute about these receptors. These receptors are in the membrane, and they're diffusing around the membrane. So the membrane allows diffusion of the receptors, right? And the receptors have two parts to them. There's the extracellular part, which is going to bind the hormone, and then there's an intracellular part that's transmembrane and in the cell, which turns out to be a protein kinase. And it turns out not only to be a protein kinase, it phosphorylates tyrosine residues. Right? And every hormone is bivalent. And so what a hormone does is bring together two receptors. So the bivalent hormone in the membrane, you're diffusing along, you've got a hormone and you come together, and now you've brought together two receptors in the hormone. The protein kinases work on the other guy, right? And you get phosphorylation of the tyrosine. Right? Tyrosine phosphorylation is a signal for growth in the cell. Right? That is a quintessentially, you could measure the number of phosphorylated tyrosines and you'd get a growth index. Right? Serine and threonine phosphorylation events don't necessarily do that, they do other things, but tyrosine phosphorylation is a signal for growth. The way tyrosines that are phosphorylated are recognized is by adaptor proteins, which bind to the phosphorylated tyrosines in the intracellular part of the membrane, right, that are being held together. Right? Those adaptor proteins then attract other enzymatic activities to the membrane. They fit in the adapter. Right? So a name of an adaptor protein is called GRB, GRB. It binds to phosphotyrosine, and it will bind PI3 kinase, right? Phosphoinositol kinase, PI3 kinase. It binds this guy, right? To the adapter, right? Now, what is PI3 kinase? PI3 kinase is a kinase, right? But it doesn't phosphorylate a protein, it phosphorylates a lipid. The name of the lipid it phosphorylates is inositol, right? And PI3 kinase means it has three phosphorylation events on the lipid. Right? And the name of the lipid then becomes PIK3, phospho and also told triphosphate. Right? So PI3 kinase at the membrane synthesizes PIK3. PIK3 is a small molecular weight molecule that activates other protein kinases. Right? Now that diffuses throughout the cell, and it's going to activate other protein kinases. One of them is called mTOR, or TORC2. Another one is called PEK1. These are protein kinases. And these protein kinases phosphorylate another protein kinase called AKT1. Now, like, remember cyclin D1, 2, and 3, this AKT1, 2, and 3, there's lots of redundancy here. Let's not worry about it. AKT is the product of this line. Now, you will see lots of times when we go through RAS and will be G proteins and then kinases, but you will see lots of times where a series of protein kinases are phosphorylating each other in a row to get to the end product. And the general strategy is that since they're catalytic, a little activity in the first one spreads to a lot of activity in the second, to a tremendous amount of activity in the third. Right? So this signal transduction pathway of having protein kinase, right? And PIK3, right? This pathway, right, is meant to amplify the signal.
Is it also adaptive? And if IGF is rising, then it's used to turn down, like in hemotaxis?
Exactly. So what will happen, a nice way to show adaptation is, AKT is an oncogene, actually so is PIK. PI3 kinase, remember? Actually, PI3 kinase was the third or the second largest mutation in breast cancer. Right? So here's the second largest mutation in breast cancer. And what is it going to do? It's going to regulate the metabolic pathways. Yeah.
So the intracellular part of the receptor contains all these tyrosine kinases.
Yes.
PI3 kinase is one of those, or it comes in the...
No. It's bound to the adapter. Yeah. It's bound to the adapter. Okay, so now we've gotten through the signal transduction from the signal outside to AKT. AKT moves from the cytoplasm to the nucleus, where it phosphorylates a series of repressive transcription factors called forkhead transcription factors, or FOXO transcription factors, right? So these transcription factors sit in the nucleus all the time. They sit on certain genes. One of the genes is cyclin D. Right? They sit on certain genes, and they repress them. The phosphorylation of those genes by of the FOXO transcription factors by AKT takes them out of the nucleus and puts them in the cytoplasm and de-represses the transcription of genes, right? And so this is, in fact, a great generalization of all signal transduction pathways. They may start on the outside. They have a signal transduction pathway through the cytoplasm. They always end up activating a transcription factor and changing the transcriptional profile of the cell. And when FOXOs leave the nucleus, we get a tremendous burst of positive regulators for preparing for cell cycle growth. It actually increases the mass of the cell by getting ribosomes made, by getting heat shock proteins made. Heat shock proteins are stress-related proteins, chaperones to fold proteins. It's gearing up in G1 to move the cell into cycle, right? And it is turning on all of the glycolytic enzymes. It positively regulates the glycolytic enzymes in the pathway, right? Okay, so we're now at the point where this part of the pathway has signaled, right? But remember I told you in every growth-related pathway that we're talking about, there's two signals that are important. One is nutrients, and the other is growth factors. I've just taken you through the growth factor pathway. The other part of the insulin-like growth factor pathway is growth factor-related, right? And so let's say we do the following. Is glucose and glutamine related? Right. Is nutrient related? Nutrient related. Thank you. Now, how do we measure? How does the cell measure the amount of glucose that it has? That's an interesting question. Certainly, by the way, the beta cells, which are secreting insulin, actually do measure the amount of glucose by using the enzyme hexokinase, A hexokinase is the enzyme that takes glucose and gives you glucose 6-phosphate, right? And its binding constant is set to measure the amount of glucose you have, right? So you can measure it by hexokinase activity. However, in this case, we're measuring in a totally different way. We're measuring the AMP to ATP levels. Now, ATP is the energy current. The precursor is adenosine monophosphate. So if I starve you for glucose, if none of you had breakfast or lunch, your AMP levels rise. Why? You don't have enough glucose to run through the TCA cycle. Your ATP levels have fallen, you've used your reserves, and your AMP levels are high. Okay? Now, when your AMP levels are high, that's sensed by the beta subunit of an enzyme called AMP kinase. So AMP kinase is a trimer, right? It has a beta subunit that binds AMP. And when that happens, it turns on the gamma subunit, which is the catalytic subunit for phosphorylation, right? And the alpha subunit is the bridge between the two, right? So it is measuring AMP levels in the cell. So when you're starving for glucose, AMP levels go up, AMP kinase reads, right? Okay. Now, what does AMP kinase do? AMP kinase phosphorylates, right? TSC2 and TSC1, right? Now these are, so now I'm going to take you to your first encounter with a G protein called RET. So let me tell you about G proteins. Just as protein kinases are critical for signal transduction pathways, G proteins are critical, right? Now, G proteins are simply transistors. That's all they are. They have two states, on and off. When they're on, they bind a small molecule called GTP, right? That's the nucleotide, GTP, right? When they're off, GTP goes to GDP, right? So when you want to turn it off, there is a GTPase, right? A GTPase which changes GTP to GDP, and you've got from on to off. And if you want to turn it back on, you have a nucleotide loader which throws out GDP and puts in GTP, right? So they're actually a G protein sitting in two states, right, on and off, and everything's regulated by the GTP concentration, right? That's red. TSC1 and TSC2 is a GTPase, right? It is the GTPase for the G protein Reb, right? So now Reb is a G protein in the on state. It will turn on mTOR Raptor or TORC1, right? TORC1 now turns on when it turns on, right? When TORC1 turns on, right? It actually does two things. One is it affects translation of messenger RNAs, not transcription, but translation. And it affects it by two enzymes. S6 kinase is a kinase that phosphorylates the sixth protein on the small ribosomal subunit. And that enhances translation. And 4-EBP allows for messenger RNAs to be translated. It's an initiation factor for translation, right? So here you're regulating transcription for growth. Here you're regulating translation for growth, right? And everything depends upon the concentration. So let's take a look at the starvation situation. Starvation situation is I've now turned on AMP, right? AMP kinase. It phosphorylated TSC1, TSC2. It increased the GTPase, so it inhibited Reb. If it inhibited Reb, that inhibits the Raptor, right? If that inhibits it, translation shut down. And as soon as this mTOR, right, is inhibited, another process called autophagy is turned on. And autophagy is scavenging from yourself, right? So let me describe autophagy, because that's turned on when you starve for glucose. What happens when you starve for glucose? You lose weight, right? The longer you can keep going, the more weight you'll lose, right? How does that happen? Well, you have AMP high. You have activation of the GTPase. It turns off Reb. It turns off mTOR, right? If mTOR is turned off, then the first thing that happens is new vesicles are made in the cell. They're called autophagy vesicles, or autophagosomes, right? They scavenge proteins and nucleic acids from the cytoplasm. They degrade it, and they put it back out. You're eating yourself, right? you start degrading your own proteins, you start degrading your own lipids, right? Cells get smaller, right? The mass goes down. The mass goes down, they're not going to divide. You are withdrawing from the cycle under these conditions, all because you're sensing no glucose through AMP, right? Poolside, through this pathway, right? What happens when I add glucose back? I get high ATP, low AMP. This doesn't work, this doesn't work, this does work, this does work, I now translate again. Right? So, and the same thing is true, by the way, for amino acids. The amino acids are being sensed to another pathway, and yet to another path here and in here. Now.
Sorry.
Yeah.
We work with red, and that G protein is kind of strange that the expression level of red really changes. So I was just wondering, you know, there's a transcriptional regulation, so it's not just GTP binding. So could there be like
key? Well, you can have as much red as you want. If you don't have GTP there, you just don't have it on, right?
Right. But the GTP kind of switch is important, but it also seems to kind of respond to expression.
Protein concentration could go up or down
right. In
many, many interesting ways, and I'm sure that has an effect.
Right. But this
but really, the level of it being regulating raptor is through the GTP.
Right, but I just wondered whether there could be P53 regulation of raptor.
So, well, I'll take a look at that in a minute. I've obviously emphasized on these slides, because these slides come from a review I wrote, which was meant to show what P53 does to these pathways, but there are many genes that work on these pathways in different ways. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a bit confused about the transcription of the AKT is an oncogene.
AKT is an oncogene.
It shuts down 4K. And then P21 is supposed to. That should be.
I'm going to get to that. I'm going to get to that in a few minutes. Don't worry about it yet.
It's inconsistent because P21 is supposed to stop proliferation rather than, I mean, it seems to be the same thing as AKT.
What it's doing is inhibiting forkhead from leaving the nucleus and acting as a transcription factor. It's keeping it as a repressor.
But AKT is not enough.
That's right. No, AKT plus Rawlings and it leaves the nucleus.
So, in Nordic people, is there any permanent
people that suffer
from anorexia?
Oh, anorexic, yes. Okay.
Are there any permanent damages that are detected within this specific cycle?
They are eating themselves up at alarming rates. Their autophagic reactions are very high. I'm sure that they may have caused permanent damage to reproductive organs, permanent damage to the brain, but I don't know. I don't know much about anorexic women. So. It's actually quite an interesting thing because it's sexually dimorphic. It's 98% women.
I actually read somewhere that the pancreatic enzymes are being affected.
Well, they may.
In male anorexia.
Yeah.
So Deborah, in the winter of 1944 to 45 in the Netherlands, there was a very sharp peak in famine because, let's say, our neighbors took some of the food. But you can follow that call for 2 hours. And that period of one winter of famine, where apparently it was damaged, it seemed to affect everything. All levels of disease were enlarged. It seemed to have global effects on the whole body. You could follow it, and I mean, by now they have passed away, but it was very well known. People would always ask whether you went through that winter, and then they would know that there would be this systemic degradation.
So, as you might guess, the developing organisms are more sensitive than adults.
The children
are just really devastated. A child brought up in malnutrition is never going to recover. Yeah. It's actually quite interesting. In the generation after Mao died in China, in that generation, I think the women grew an extra foot in the next generation. They actually were literally stunted by the malnutrition, and that so it wasn't that they didn't reach, they just never reached their potential height.
I'm wondering, the cell signaling cycles are sometimes very confusing for physicists. There are tons of terms like peroxide and glutamine and glycolysis and kinase and tyrosines and gene protein. I was wondering whether it would be useful for the students if there was like an hour or so where we also have another biochemist here for you. If the two of you could just be around the students, and they would have the opportunity to ask you. So just focus on the key.
Sometimes it's even better to spend an hour with Albert's book.
Okay. But it's kind of big, Albert's book. You spend more than 1 hour.
There's a chapter for. It's called Chapter for Physicists, right? I mean,
is it?
Oh, yeah. When anybody shows up at the Institute for Advanced Studies, we give them Albert's book.
But there seem to be particular pathways which are very important for cancer, and it might be helpful if students could ask you questions about if they're not familiar with the terminology.
So you can see this pathway is very pro-growth. And this pathway, so let's just look at it, right? The IGF gene is an oncogene. The IGF receptor is an oncogene. PI3 kinase is an oncogene. AKT is an oncogene. TSC2 and TSC1 are tumor suppressor genes. AMP kinase is not, but LKB, which is another activator here, is actually one of the highest mutated genes in lung cancer. Right? It's an oncogene. mTOR has a major inhibitor called everolimus that Novartis makes. That if you, this is what we were talking about, Boris, at lunch a little bit. If you inhibit downstream, everything upstream that it went wrong is stopped, right? And so they made the inhibitor here. And actually, anyone with TSC1 or TSC2 mutation, which are tumor suppressor genes, you couldn't you have to replace, right? Now you can block them downstream, right? By this inhibitor, right? This is a major oncogene, the 4EBP1, major oncogene. So this is littered with, this P10, I'll get to in a minute, is a tumor suppressor gene. So this pathway is just littered with oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes, as are many other signal transduction pathways. And this pathway regulates the growth of cells as they move through G1 into S phase, right? The major and the metabolic pathways that we talk about. Now, what's quite interesting about, so we spent maybe 4 or 5 years, that's why we wrote this review, asking a simple question. If this is a major growth pathway, what happens if during growth you have a stress? DNA damage, hypoxia, heat shock, cold shock, nutrient deprivation, what happens? P53 rises. So what does P53 do to shut down this pathway? Well, the first thing it does is it actually makes a gene called P10, it transcribes a gene called P10, which is a phosphatase, and it degrades PIP3. If you degrade PIP3, every one of these kinases is shut down. Right? The lipid kinase. It is a quintessential central step to stop. Right? So P53 just shuts them down. And this is true only in tissues, so it has tissue specificity, that utilize insulin for glucose uptake. It really makes some sense. Right? In addition, P53 makes an insulin-like growth factor binding protein. That means it sequesters the insulin, it secretes it, and sequesters the insulin-like growth factor, which is its hormone that started the pathway. Right? What happens when you have growth and you want to shut down P53 is AKT phosphorylates MDM2. MDM2 is the ubiquitin ligase of P53, inhibits it, its activity goes up, and it inhibits P53. So these pathways mutually inhibit each other, but in a stress situation, the whole thing shut down. Right? So what we're watching these two kinds of forms playing out, right? Stress signal, stop the growth. Right? Shut down the pathway. Absolute growth, shut down the stress signal. Right? Those are two important kinds of players here. And what happens in breast cancer, remember, was you lost P53 and PI3 kinase when constitutive. You threw it into growth and you had no way to stop it. Right? And that's why when Boris says, hey, this pathway is shut down, the P53 pathway is shut down, the way to stop it, right? And the PI3 kinase pathway is activated with a mutation. Yeah.
As there is a lot of communication that goes in the wrong direction, I was wondering if you also can.
Communication goes in the wrong direction.
There are a lot of.
There's a lot of arrows.
Ways that are in cancer are I don't know, it's like moving in the wrong direction.
Oh, I see. They're going toward growth and they stop apoptosis, yes.
I'm wondering if you can...
I thought you meant that this is a self-contradictory path.
No,
it's in the wrong direction.
No, and so I was wondering, as you told before, that you can check if a cell has cancer, for example, because it's absorbing a lot of glucose. If, for example, checking, I don't know, calcium level or ubiquitin that are more or less involved in signal transduction.
It's easier it's a more reliable way to diagnose cancer with 2-deoxyglucose than with calcium. It is true that calcium changes. It doesn't change uniformly in cancer cells. It changes in some cells. It can have importance in mobility. It can have importance. One of the things I really want to do with you, I'm going to quit on this one and not. I want to introduce you to a couple of the pathways, especially the Wnt pathway, because on Friday we're going to hear about colon cancer, and the Wnt pathway is really important for colon cancer, so it's a good one to introduce. There, calcium plays a big role, for example. Right? The cell-cell adhesion is through a calcium-mediated cation. So there are some places where calcium is more important than others. But as a generalization, a doc would not use calcium as a diagnostic tool. Okay, so let's just let's call this guy a day, if I'm clever enough. Oh no, I got it down, but oop! Oh God! All I can do is get everybody down, right? Aha! How do you like that? Oh, what did I do? I just screwed up my computer. I'm just ending show here. And then I will... So it's probably... No, I don't want to save. Let me save. It's probably... Let me just get out of here now. Not doing well. Okay. You haven't been logged out because the application of Microsoft PowerPoint failed. This is where my computer is really very pleasant. Gotta log out. Okay. Oop. So remember I told you there's a lot of developmental pathways, and I think they'd be probably worthwhile to talk about the Wnt pathway because it's so remarkably coordinated between different things in so many interesting ways that it's a kind of fun pathway. So Wnt is a Wnt, W-N-T, was first found in Drosophila. It is a mutation, and it is called wingless. The Drosophila was born without wings. So it is a pathway that makes wings, among other things, in Drosophila. Wnt was then found to be next to a breast cancer, a virus that inserted into the chromosome, a retrovirus, inserted into the chromosome and activated a gene adjacent to the virus, the retrovirus. And this activation of transcription was in fact a gene called INT, I-N-T, integration. And it caused breast cancer in mice. And then when it was sequenced, it was shown to be wingless. So it came to be called Wnt. So now we had a mouse gene and a Drosophila gene, which caused breast cancer in mice, caused wing deformations, right? If you knock Wnt out in the mouse, you don't get kidneys, you don't get a lot of things, right? Wnt is important as restoring the immune system, a whole bunch of things, right? This is a developmental pathway that has oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes, and that actually integrates many different properties in a cell. And it has the virtue of having something to do with calcium. It's the same time. Right? So just like anything else, the hormone is called Wnt. Right? Wnt acts on the cell, and it acts on the receptor. Right? And the receptor, the Wnt receptor, is called frizzle. No, not frizzle. It's called, frizzled. Sorry, that's right. I was just thinking of disheveled. Right? It's called frizzled. Frizzled, right? Now, let me just take you through the nomenclature here, because you're going to find this nomenclature bizarre, right? And the reason is it's all the fault of the Drosophila people, right? So Wnt pathway was first worked out very intensively in Drosophila. And they found the receptor for Wnt that was called frizzled. Then a guy at Hopkins found that same receptor in the eye, and he had to call it frizzled, right? So there are 12 frizzled receptors. There are 5 different Wnts, right? Let's not worry about it. There's just Wnt and there's frizzled, right? When Wnt and frizzled come together, it activates a protein called disheveled. Now, disheveled is exactly what the embryo looks like, right? So this is the Drosophila people telling you what the embryo looks like. Now, not only is it wingless, but if you've got disheveled, it's a mess, right? It's disheveled, right? Or it's frizzled looking, right? It's exactly what the embryo looks like, right? Disheveled then activates a protein called glucagon synthetase.
Glycogen synthetase
kinase 3. Let me just get it out, otherwise. Jeez.
Arnie, would you like to take a break, maybe?
I just want to, you can get me a drink, actually.
There's coffee and tea and cookies.
Yeah. Well, is it? So, why don't we take a break? I was just looking for my. Here it is, okay. Glycogen synthetase kinase 3. All right. And we'll stop here. We'll get a drink. Yeah. Otherwise, my mind is filled. I've now gone 7 hours or 8 hours of this.
All right, so heroic performance, Harry.
Heroic is not the word. Okay, so two reasons just to pick up on one more. I'm going to show another example of it, of course, but we're going to hear more about colon cancer, and this pathway is pretty central to colon cancer. And secondly, this is a pathway that actually, what's more important in my mind, is that it integrates a couple of different things in the cell in a very nice way, which has to do with the cell cycle, which has to do with mobility, which has to do with a number of things.
There's a gasket.
You'll hear more about the structure of the colon and things like that. On Friday, but this pathway again starts with the hormone outside the cell Wnt engaging its receptor, whose name happens to be frizzle, doesn't really matter, and then that engaging the disheveled, which turns on an enzyme that had been found a long time ago, glycogen synthetase kinase 3 beta. So this enzyme is in your liver, actually, and it is responsible for the activating the enzyme that takes glycogen, which is a polyglucose, down to glucose, and then the utilization of glucose. Right? So it's been part of the metabolic cycle for a long time, but it's reutilized in this pathway in an interesting way. Right? The main player in the pathway is a protein called beta catenin. And beta catenin is one part of the two-part transcription factor. And it is phosphorylated by glycogen synthetase 3 beta. And the phosphorylation then makes it resistant to ubiquitination, which would normally occur. And in being resistant to ubiquitination, the concentration rises.
Remind me, Arnie, beta-catenin connects the cytokinin adhesion molecules to the cytoskeleton.
I haven't really figured it out. I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. That's why it's pretty interesting. So it is the major player as the transcription factor, and it is the whole result of the signal transduction pathway. The beta catenin sits on a platform and this platform is a protein, a large protein called APC. Right? And without this protein, you can't ubiquitinate beta catenin and you can't degrade it. Right? Now, what's really interesting about APC is it's a tumor suppressor gene. It's inherited at mutations, and when it's inherited, it leads to colon cancer. So that's how it was originally found. It was originally found APC. See, defective in people that result got colon cancer. But it is also the gatekeeper mutation in colon cancer. It's one of the earliest mutations. And this, when this is lost, right, then beta catenin is stabilized. It just can't be degraded. And when it's stabilized, your oncogene is stabilized. So this is the tumor suppressor gene that's negatively regulating its oncogene here. So when you have stabilized beta catenin, it moves to the nucleus. It then picks up a second protein called TCF4, which is a transcription factor. And together, beta catenin and TCF. I will not repeat this.
At least part of it.
So, okay. Well, we'll hear it on Friday.
From the bottom.
When APC is mutant, beta catenin is not degraded. When it's not degraded, it moves to the nucleus. It combines with TCF4, and one of its major substrates is cyclin D, which is a big player for us that we learned about right away. It transcribes cyclin D. Cyclin D moves it through the cell cycle, and then you get growth, right? So this is a pathway for growth and development, right, where the major oncogene is beta catenin. So actually, the most common mutation is APC as a gatekeeper, but we also see a certain percentage of colon cancers with beta catenin mutations, which are mutations in the phosphorylation sites. There's one mutation in beta catenin which deletes the phosphorylation sites. And when you delete phosphorylation sites, it's very stable. Right? So here we have a situation whereby everything is made to increase the concentration of beta catenin to the nucleus. Right? Now, one of the reasons this is pretty interesting is that the catenins are absolutely essential for the tightest adhesion junctions in cells. So in the colon, you have a situation where you have lots of surface area, which you're absorbing through, and cell-cell contacts are very tight and held tightly. And they're held tightly through molecules. This is an example of a transmembrane molecule called cadherins. And two cadherins from two different cells, I mean, there's hundreds of these cadherins, but two cadherins from two different cells utilize calcium to make tight adhesion junctions, right? But these adhesion junctions are not functional unless they have beta catenin and a close neighbor, alpha catenin, associated with the adherence junctions. So this is quite interesting. If you think about it, if you have a sheet, right, and you want to divide, you'll buckle the sheet if you try to divide, right? So you want to coordinate the making and breaking of adherence junctions so that the sheet can just get larger, right? Or a tube can just get larger. And this is a way that, here's the same molecule as a transcription factor being used in regulating adherence junctions. And the third kind of a regulation is that what binds to and organizes alpha catenin is the actin filaments. And the actin filaments are part of the cytoskeleton of the cell. And so the movement of the cell and the cytoskeleton of the cell is coordinated with beta and alpha catenin as well. Right? So here's a signal transduction pathway that tries to use the same molecules to coordinate three different physiological properties: transcription for growth, adherence junctions, and cytoskeleton. Right?
So do you need it to form the junction or to hold it?
You need it for both. It holds the junction, but it forms the junction also. Without it, you don't have a junction. This is the point. Well, if I use a calcium chelator and take away calcium, I don't have a junction.
Michael, many of these adhesion molecules are stress sensitive. They work only if they can, if they feel a force. So without the junction, you don't form the junction.
I mean, extracellular, I can see. I'm trying to see how you can change something intracellular to break the junction extracellular to the membrane. How would it? What's happening outside?
You mean inside?
From inside to outside.
You mean how does this communicate?
After you form it, let's say if you remove it, what happens outside?
fact, you form this trio?
After you form everything, and then you remove your alpha cadherin.
Oh, if you took away the alpha cadherin, the junction would break.
Right. Why?
But why? Because he's saying that the binding energy should be independent of what goes on inside.
You don't need energy to keep.
You could say that, but it's not true. So, I mean, you could say that any way you want, but it's not true. So it's very common that one protein or one ligand, small molecular ligand, binding to a protein changes the shape of a protein, changes its active site, right? So, for example, there are second proteins that bind to the first that completely shut down the catalytic activity, right? So it could well be, I don't know if this is true, but it could well be that you need alpha and beta catenin to actually bind calcium. And that's because there's an allosteric effect across this protein whereby the shape of the protein over here is affected by the interaction of the molecules here. Right? So that's a common way in which proteins do work. They work with allosteric effectors.
Another effect is called the catch bond. If there's a bond under stress, and if you release the stress, then the bond goes off.
So I can tell with this one, actually. So it's the fact that it binds to actin, right? So of course these things, the cadherins are binding and unbinding, right? That's what's constantly happening. But of course they would diffuse as well. But when they're bound to alpha catenin, which is bound to actin, their mobility on the membrane is reduced, which means that even if they're unbound state, now they're going to kind of basically still stay around that local region because they're actually bound to actin, which biases basically.
So my naive thing is something.
He says it limits diffusion. If you had unlimited diffusion, it wouldn't work well.
Well, that's part of it. It's complicated. That's part of it.
Sticking out and the cadherin on it from the outside.
The cadherin's half on the outside, past the transmembrane on the inside. And here the alpha and beta catenin, and here's the actin, right? You inverted the inside and the outside, yeah.
So when the beta catenin binds to the membrane, is it still subject to the APC degradation or protected from the degradation?
Yeah, so there's a problem here, and the problem is anytime. So you might have thought that you'd make a pool of alpha and beta catenin, and the beta catenin pools would be shifting in equilibrium between the membrane and the transcription factor, and they would have some relationship. But they appear to be really segregated. You cannot find these pools interacting. And so one of the things I said is a stretch, because I said, hey, you've got the same molecule regulating adhesion as you do transcription. But you really don't. They're in separate pools. And I say that because people have tried to manipulate the levels of beta catenin, right, and not change the levels at the membrane and change the levels at the nucleus, right? And so there's some things happening here which are ill-defined. But it's the same molecules in both places.
You mean they're physically separate?
Yeah, they're actually, it's almost as if you lived in two separate houses and you didn't exchange, right? Well, I call that pools in the cell, right? Yeah, yeah.
Well, there are presumably more phosphorylation sites on beta catenin, which target the membrane, and those adherence junctions are chock full of kinases, which are something dependent, maybe tension dependent, and perhaps maintain phosphorylation of beta catenin so that it stays in adherence junctions.
So while beta catenin is an oncogene, that's pretty clear. Actually, alpha catenin looks like a tumor suppressor gene in many ways. So if you have an inducible alpha catenin and you have it in the ovarian cancer, for example, often has alpha catenin mutation. And then if you replace that in an inducible way, cells change dramatically. They move from disheveled all the way to ordered, right? And that's because you're remaking these cadherin junctions by remaking this actin.
And so why don't they exchange this? Did Boris explain why they exchange, or was that?
You may like his explanation, or you may not.
I understand.
Like
what prevents diffusion? Is that like a membrane, a barrier?
I think we'll be discussing this at great length.
He's suggesting that the actin filaments anchor this so that the protein that's attached to the actin filaments doesn't diffuse. And in other words, he's suggesting that you keep the beta-catenin, the cadherins in a local area, and therefore they don't separate from each other. And that's a suggestion that's maybe right, maybe not, but. Okay, that's another example of a signal transduction pathway. There are 20, 30 signal transduction pathways everyone used in development, many of them associated with different kind of cancers. There's a hormone called sonic hedgehog, which is important for basal cell carcinomas, for which now there's a drug, and the basal cell carcinomas go away. It's really quite amazing once you get the right drugs for these pathways, that one by one they're starting to fall, right? Although there's no drug for this pathway yet.
So speaking of these,
I'm actually seriously done. You're not interrupting.
I'll ask one question.
Yeah. Please, yeah. Good time for questions.
So you were telling us about the insulin growth factor signaling and as a regulator of growth. And I guess my question is, so you haven't told us very much about the differentiation factors, in the sense that the epithelial cells are supposed to be post-mitotic in the first place. Does just pouring IGF on them make them divide? I don't think so, right? You have to do something else to them first, right? So you have to turn them...
So that's
I'll
give you a bit.
IGF, then you will,
I'll give you a quick crises on this. So, on Tuesday, I'm going to talk exactly about this question at the lunch, right? So I'm not going to go into it in great detail, but let me just point out something I'll start with on Tuesday, so you guys will hear it twice, right? In 1960s. Gurdon at Cambridge, England, asked the question that Boris has gotten around to 40 years later, right? 50 years later, right? Independently gotten around to 40 or 50 years later. Right? He said, every cell in the body has the same amount of DNA. He, of course, had no sequence to show that it always had the same exact DNA. But he said, there's the same amount of DNA, so maybe it has the exact same amount of DNA, right? And you start off with a fertilized egg, and it all looks pretty homogeneous. And you end up with 130 different cell types that have different functions, that have different proteins, that have different activities, right? And yet they all have the same DNA, right? So how does this happen? How does this come about, right? Because it isn't that you're eliminating the DNA. You're differentially expressing the DNA in some way, right? So he formulated the question in such a way so as to say, is it true that if I take the nucleus from a differentiated cell and reprogram an egg with that nucleus, is it true that I'd make a frog again? Right? He did it with frogs. Right? So he worked out a way to kill the nucleus in a frog egg. Right? So he killed the nucleus in a frog egg with a laser beam. So the frog had a perfectly good egg, but no nucleus. He then took the nucleus from a tadpole, right, which is cheating a little. It's not quite a frog, but it's a tadpole. And he inoculated the nucleus back into the egg. Right? And he said, if it has all of the genes to make a tadpole, I'll make a tadpole. Right?
What kind of sex is the tadpole?
Tadpole is just as good as an adult. I mean, it's a funny looking frog with a long tail. Yeah.
Out of the 100 different kinds of egg of cells that the tadpole has, which one
he? Oh, I think he took it from one of the epithelial cells, but
epithelial cells. So it's a fully differentiated.
It's fully differentiated cell. Yeah, fully differentiated cell. Later on, this guy in Scotland did it with the udder cells of a sheep, and right. Yeah. So he put it back in the egg, right? Now, everyone fully expected that he would get a tadpole, right? But he didn't. He did this experiment 10 times, it all failed. It always failed. So Gurdon was much more clever than saying, it failed, so something must be missing, right? So he then took the nucleus and he passaged it through eggs. Right? So he put it in one egg, he let it sit for a day, took it out. He put it in a second egg, he let it sit for a day, took it out. He's now passaging it through eggs. Right? In the parlance of today, he's deprogramming the nucleus. Right? But the nucleus has some program that made it an epithelial cell. Right? And it isn't so simple as to just put that program into an egg and expect it to work. It's got to be deprogrammed, and deprogramming occurs in eggs. But it's like a test tube. He's putting in fresh deprogramming enzymes each time. And so by the fourth or fifth transfer, he could then put it in an egg, and it developed and it made a tadpole. Right? So out of Gruden's experiment, he said, aha, has all of the DNA to make all of the cells of a frog, right? So there must be another program that makes it differentiate, which came to be called the epigenetic program, right? Not genetic, but epigenetic program, right? Because it was inherited in the following sense. If you have liver cells, they make liver cells. If you have brain cells, they make brain cells, right? And in fact, they start off with progenitor cells and stem cells and things like that, right? And so he called it the epigenetic program. And he said, the epigenetic program is pretty strong. It took me four or five passages to deprogram it in an egg. But the egg and the sperm are deprogramming, right? So you have, when I make sperm and when women make eggs, you deprogram them so that they are completely deprogrammed. There's no epigenetic marks. They come together. And then as differentiation occurs, epigenetic marks occur, right? Right. Now, let me not be so vague about what epigenetic marks are. They come in two flavors. The first is methylation of cytosine residues when the dinucleotide CpG is found in DNA, right? That's an epigenetic mark. It tells some genes to read. It tells other genes to turn off, right? And the second is methylation, acetylation, ubiquitination, phosphorylation of histones that the DNA wraps around, right? So as a generalization, hyperacetylated histones are permissive for transcription. There are some methylated histones at certain sites, which as a generalization, there's not any real hard rules, but as a generalization, you can methylate at certain sites and turn genes off, right? So there's an epigenetic, some people say, because this is a really, this is new stuff and it's a bone of contention. Some people say there's an epigenetic code of methylation, acetylation, ubiquitination, phosphorylation, which says your gene on, your gene off. And that's what differentiation is about, is laying out the program of epigenetic
code. It's sitting in the cytoplasm of the egg, this program.
So. Yes, it actually is, yeah. Sitting in the cytoplasm of the egg, but diffuses into the nucleus.
So can you have cancer entirely with epigenetics? Can you have any mutation?
First of all, this morning we had five breast cancers that had no mutations that could be seen, right? So that would be a hypothesis for those breast cancers. Maybe those are five are epigenetic, right? No reason not to, because you could turn on oncogenes and you could turn off tumor suppressor genes. You just wouldn't do it with mutation. You'd do it with an epigenetic program, right? Stem cells are known to have different epigenetic programs than are differentiated cells, right? Stem cells have totally different epigenetic programs. And what I'm going to talk about, actually, is I'll start with the Gruden experiment, but I'll then go to Yamanaka's experiments, which are to reprogram fibroblasts back to stem cells, embryonic stem cells. And then what blocks that programming? And the big surprise is tumor suppressor genes are playing a role in this programming of epigenetics. So we're coming back to that, right? There's a leukemia where an enzyme called EZH2. EZH2 methylates a particular lysine in the tail of a histone, right? EZH2 is amplified in certain tumors. So now you're actually getting genetic mutations in enzymes that change the epigenetic code. Right? And those are associated with cancers. Right?
So what about, is the epigenetic code, if it's in cytoplasm, what about paternally imprinted genes?
Well, I think it's in the nucleus also, but I mean, I think if you obliterate the nucleus and then put another nucleus in, they're probably drift back and forth.
But isn't there a wave of demethylation after fertilization that then you get reprogramming? isn't...
It might, no. Actually, cytosine methylation is erased, essentially.
Yeah.
I don't know about histone methylation.
I think
everything is
there's erased. Some forms of imprinting that can go through generations, but it's a very good assumption to say that early embryo, all the genomes are the same. Yeah. Until the action of transcription factors put in place certain epigenetic marks. Differential expression and differential action of transcription factors.
So there are some diseases, neurodegenerative diseases, other kinds of diseases, which are literally known to be epigenetic diseases, right? And then there's some imprinting which is sexually dimorphic, right? That's a good story to end on. So I'm going to. So this is a work done by Shirley Tillman. It's a it really shows a dramatic sexually dimorphic effect, and it's related to the insulin-like growth factor pathway. Told you about. That's where I think it's worth ending on. That's great. Great way to end the day, and then go out and have wine. So it turns out that the major growth factor for embryos is called insulin-like growth factor 2. It's not the one you saw, but it's the second one, right? Insulin-like growth factor 2 is a major growth factor for embryos, right? So it turns out that males, when they donate an egg to the fertilized egg, their sperm, right, have completely demethylated the insulin-like growth factor 1 gene, and it's full-blown expressed. From day one, it's expressed in the embryo, right? And females have completely turned it off. So even now, this is an example of turning a gene off in an egg, right? So they're donating a gene that's off, and the males are donating a gene that's on. Now, this only happens in mammals, right? Which are placental, give rise to placental births, internal births. Why is this happening, right? Well, it's been speculated that, of course, what the male is really interested in is having the largest babies possible that really survive, right? And if the mother happened to die at birth, that's life. I'll get another mother, right? But my babies will live, right? And, of course, what the female is really all about is I'm not going to give up all of my bone and my glucose and everything, and I'm going to get small babies so that I can be better off and have many, many births, right? And so this strategy of turning it on and off, right? So what's quite interesting is there are in the family of mouse species, right, monogamous mice, males that have one female or two females, but always the same, and polygamous mice, males that have many, right? It turns out the males that are monogamous shut the gene down a little bit to save their favorite wife, right? And the males that are polygamous have full-blown out as much insulin-like growth factor as possible, right?
Yeah. This is the whole deal that Robert Trivers is pushing.
Yes. Established?
Oh, this is quite established, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so if you take a polygamous male, right, and a monogamous female, right, so a polygamous male and monogamous female. A monogamous female allows a little insulin-like growth factor because she knows her husband is full-blown out, right? The babies are so big she always dies in childbirth. Right? Which really demonstrates, yeah. So this is, it's called the red queen strategy, right? It's really quite an interesting fact about imprinting, and it's what evolution wants each organism to have is not always in the same interest of those organisms. Right? So here we have a situations whereby there's sexual dimorphism in imprinting, there's organ differences in imprinting, things like that, but are really quite interesting. Right? That's a great way to end for today. Right?
So we're going to have a wine and cheese party today at 5 o'clock in the founder's room.
Where is that?